This is WBAI in New York. Coming up next, Ecologic.
Welcome to the June 17th, 2003 edition of Ecologic, Our Common Fate, a forum for the expression of ecological thought, analysis, and activist endeavor, with yours truly, David O., broadcasting from WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, webcasting on WBAI.org, and archived on radioforall.net. Today, culture ecology, media as environment. From Pacifica to the World Wide Web, in the first half of this hour, we will look at the history of and current events in the cultural environment of the Pacifica Radio Network. Our second half hour will focus on digital telecommunications with Jeff Chester from the Center for Digital Democracy. Beyond notions of media as commodity and or public service, media as environment underscores the need for the populace to decontaminate and restore, create and protect public space and civil society applications. Please stay tuned. Welcome to Ecologic. This is David Occhiuto. Culture ecology. What is this phrase, culture ecology? Well, a culture ecology perspective regards social groups and institutions as human ecosystems. Like natural ecosystems, they can be life supportive or depleted, regenerative or moribund. Each individual is an integral component of an interconnected system, like cells in a larger body. A body politic, so to speak. When that body is traumatized, we sense that trauma. When it falters and sickens, whether we pay attention to it or not, each one of us is enmeshed in surrounding stress and distress. The culture ecologist affirms that gradually, through living participation in the social process, including analysis and reflection, we may begin to recognize and value certain characteristics of the collective as signs of health and well-being, while other characteristics may begin to serve as warning signs that something has gone wrong in human affairs. If we choose to pursue the valuation and evolvement of a multicultural and transcultural environment, the culture ecology path suggests we search for signs of health or infirmity to see what specific patterns of collective action tend to lead toward further integration or disintegration. So as we look at the Pacifica Radio Foundation, I would like to begin by introducing people to elements of the mission statement. I feel this mission statement really brings into focus a way to attend to both the historical reality and the current reality. It's very important. If you have not familiarized yourself with the mission statement, I will just give you some excerpts. The first mission statement is to establish a foundation organized and operated exclusively for educational purposes. A subsequent precept, in radio broadcasting, operations to encourage and provide outlets for the creative skills and energies of the community, and to promote and aid other creative activities which will serve the cultural welfare of the community. The next, In radio broadcasting, operations to engage in any activity that shall contribute to a lasting understanding between nations and between the individuals of all nations, races, creeds, and colors, to gather and disseminate information on the causes of conflict between any and all of such groups, and through any and all means compatible with the purposes of this corporation, to promote the study of political and economic problems, and of the causes of religious, philosophical, and racial antagonisms. So, the mission appears to encourage what I see as a dynamic interplay between serving the cultural welfare of the community and fulfilling the foundation's charge to contribute to a culture of lasting understanding extending to both national and international scale. Big boots to fill. Now, Lou Hill was a student at Stanford University in 1937. He became interested in the ideas of the Quakers and became a pacifist. When he was drafted in 1941, he registered as a conscientious objector. In 1945, Hill resigned from his job as a Washington, D.C. correspondent and moved to California, where he founded the Pacifica Foundation, with other folks, I'm sure. He served as Pacifica's head until he died in 1957. Lou Hill's words from excerpts from The Theory Behind Public Radio. Listener sponsorship is an answer to the practical problems of getting better radio programs and keeping them. I imagine we can agree that if a sound is worth passing through the magnificent apparatus of a microphone, a transmitter, and your receiving set, it ought to convey some meaningful intelligence. There are innumerable ways of wasting time and generating nonsense, and there are also uncounted ways of making money, many of which may be pursued in broad daylight. But the elaborate machinery and the peculiar intimacy of the radio medium have better and more basic uses. The theory I want to discuss rests on two particular assumptions. First, that radio can and should be used for significant communication and art, and second, that since broadcasting is an act of communication, it ought to be subject to the same aesthetic and ethical principles as we apply to any communicative act, including the most personal. America is well supplied with remarkably talented writers, musicians, philosophers, and scientists whose work will survive for some centuries. If we want an improvement in radio worth the trouble, it is these people whose talent the medium must attract. The basic situation of broadcasting must be such that artists and thinkers have a place to work with freedom. Short of this, the suffering listener has no out. We are compelled to account for some conscious flow of influences, some creative tension between broadcaster and audience that constantly reaffirms their mutual relevance. Listener sponsorship will require this mutual stimulus if it is to exist at all. Actually, sending in the subscription, which one does not have to send in unless one particularly wants to, implies the kind of cultural engagement, as some French philosophers call it, that is surely indispensable for the sake of the whole culture. This means of supporting values that seems to them of basic and lasting importance will amount, I think, to a new focus of action or a new shaping influence that can hardly fail to strengthen all of us. These were excerpts from Lou Hill, The Theory Behind Public Radio, which can be found in a book called The Exacting Ear, The Story of Listener-Sponsored Radio, edited by Eleanor McKinney. Copyright 1966 by the Pacifica Foundation. So having explored some of those thoughts, one may glean, therefore, that the essential elements of listener sponsorship are: 1. a creative tension, a relationship between the broadcaster and the audience that constantly reaffirms their mutual relevance. And two, participation as a means of supporting values. In the evolution of listener sponsorship to listener member electorate, which we are heading towards, try to keep these two elemental qualities of listener sponsorship in mind. I'd like to bring into focus an article that I found on WBAI.net. WBAI.net. It's called Covering the News, Why Pacifica Listeners Need to Know What's Happening with Their Network, by Cliff Barney. This was posted May 1st, 2003. As I write this, a serious battle is taking place between proponents of different views on how Pacifica should promote diversity among its listeners and officers. Several members of the interim Pacifica National Board say that the battle threatens the very settlement that regained control of the network. Others say people who think like that are racist. One of the labs seems to be at loggerheads with the others over the bylaws provisions. None of this is told to Pacifica listeners, although in the meantime, we have made progress on speaking of these issues. Again, from the article. None of this is told to Pacifica listeners who are contributing record sums to the stations under the impression that the struggle for control of the network is over. It isn't, and they aren't being given the details. There is another reason Pacifica reporters need to cover this story. I am amazed that they don't see it. It is the media event of their generation. Nothing more important than the attempt to democratize Pacifica, the nation's only independent media network, has happened in my journalistic experience. This is Cliff Barney speaking. And I don't think anything will come about very soon hereafter either. What is happening now far transcends, I think, the experience Matthew Lazar chronicled in his history of early Pacifica. That was the birth and adolescence of Pacifica. Now comes the maturity. In an age of media agglomeration, when, as Amy Goodman put it on The Charlie Rose Show, corporations control what stories are covered and how big media covers them, Pacifica is, or is becoming, the lone democratically run national network. Through satellite radio, its reach can be global. In addition, Pacifica is in a position to play a role in building the whole new distribution structure required for a true popular alternative to mass media. Big story, lots of angles, plenty of ways to cover it. Pacifica should be on it. In general, it's not. Pacifica's news departments are completely missing it. They should have been on the bylaws process from the beginning, sending reporters to the committee meetings and summarizing what happens. Ignoring the process, which is what they have done, is like running a newspaper in Philadelphia in 1789 and not covering the writing of the Constitution. And in fact, this is where we are. We are in the middle of a constitutional reformulation of the foundation. And the contention between competing models of bylaws revision far transcends the debate on how to implement affirmative action. The debate is about what kind of cultural environment, what kind of governing structure will we embrace into the future. Now, before I go there, I would like to return a little bit to Matthew Lazar, because he indicates some of the beauty that was in the beginning. And I think to truly come into the present and to go into the future, we need to have a sense of these roots. And going back and forth in time here, bear with me to return to the era of World War II. Pacifists, Lazar writes, during the Second World War concluded that to wield greater influence, pacifism would have to create institutions that by sheer existential will positioned pacifist ideas in the center of American culture rather than at its margins. Organized pacifism would have to venture from its perch as a Cassandra-like outsider into American society. Adherents of nonviolence would have to create cultural institutions that placed pacifist beliefs at the core of an inclusive representation of the world, organized and managed by pacifists. These institutions and activities would draw to themselves people of all walks and political spectra who would engage in conversations centered on pacifist questions. Such ventures would demonstrate the viability of pacifism and human cooperation rather than simply propagandize it. To demonstrate the viability of pacifism and human cooperation rather than simply propagandize it. For the first Pacificans to be human meant to be engaged in creative and non-exploitative activity with other humans. This was what Eleanor McKinney meant when she referred to the Pacifica philosophy as one of humanism. So, Lewis Hill and his friends set out to create the Pacifica Foundation. Released from years of rural exile during the Second World War, they emerged during a brief time and place of expansive optimism. Fascism had been crushed, and the United Nations had just been established. San Francisco's unique culture nourished a new generation of visionary poets, but this window of opportunity quickly closed. By the mid-1950s, the Foundation's principals knew that their task would not be to encourage a Pacific world in the present, but to guide their network through the crossfire of McCarthyism. This painful passage forced its leaders to reconstruct their broadcasting mission, making a clean break from one mode of free speech to another. The first saw the encouragement of radical dialogue as its primary task. The second emphasized the right of the individual to speak, particularly the individual denied such a right. The first mode of free speech had its origins in American pacifism. The second had its roots in a liberal progressivism that sought to defend the rights of free speech. In 1983, looking at the second generation of Pacificans, the second generation of Pacificans instinctively knew that they had left something behind, but events now moved far too quickly to permit a comprehensive assessment of the past. Throughout Pacificana, stations began dividing into departments, sub-departments, and radio collectives devoted to wide-ranging interests from women's rights to Latin American revolution to union struggles in the United States, all producing original, path-breaking programming, but the pervasive sense of fragmentation that permeated the network could not be denied. In 1983, KPFA station manager David Salniker consented to an interview with a scholar on radical media. How would he describe the station's institutional culture? The writer asked. Bureaucratically managed individualism, Salniker tersely replied. I have yet to have the experience of someone coming to me and urging that their program should be taken off the air, and rarely of someone coming to me and saying they want to cede their time to give space to a key issue. Indeed, as a totality, KPFA more often resembled a single-room occupancy hotel than a town hall meeting. Individual programmers fiercely guarded their programs, since the individually owned show now often represented the fundamental building block of the station's program schedule. This pattern was only exacerbated by FCC policies that made it difficult, if not impossible, to establish more than a few listener-supported radio stations in any urban region, creating, in effect, a planned scarcity of public access airtime. Turf battles disguised themselves as ideological debates. In the larger sense, while Pacifica's diverse array of programmers each cultivated a radical stance toward the larger society, in their own institutional settings they operated within a framework of liberal individualism, inherited from the Foundation's struggle with McCarthyism. The position of dissenter, disseminator of the alternative point of view, reified what Richard Hofstadter described as the fiercely individualistic and capitalistic nature of American culture. Addicted, in Steve Post's words, to its constitutional right to speak, no matter what community values dissent radio claimed to uphold, as a fragmented and internally contested broadcasting schedule, it validated the dominant culture, one that functioned more as a legalistic system of individual rights than as a purveyor of dialogue. The ideology of dissent had proven indispensable in defending the Pacifica Foundation from McCarthyism, empowering the network to challenge the national security state throughout the 50s and 60s. Dissent ideology also aided feminist and ethnic programmers, who often encountered ugly hostility to their proposals for more diverse broadcasting at Pacifica stations. But as time progressed, the Pacifica Foundation's dissent culture overdispersed itself, inadequately substituting for what the network urgently needed, a general theory of non-commercial broadcasting that prioritized listening over talking, recognition over declaration, and mutual obligation over individual rights. With that background, we can now look at the current situation. Without belaboring the current history of the last few years, I recognize that what happened was a movement was brought about to counter being imposed upon by self-selecting local boards and national boards. These governing boards were self-selecting bodies. The movement recognized that we needed freedom from the corrupting influence of self-selecting bodies. And we also recognized that we needed freedom of expression in general, and especially freedom of expression in the right and the obligation to openly discuss governance of the foundation on the air. As well, many listeners recognize that there is the right of the listener to participate in the guardianship, guidance, and growth of this non-commercial communications institution, which he or she values and supports. So, the lawsuit that settled the recent hijacking brought about the need to establish accountability to the listener members. And the model that was put into place legally was a election model where the listener members would be pursuing accountability, democratic accountability. So the why is there. The oversight of the foundation was formally and currently in the hands of self-selecting local and national boards. In the process, the birth venture, labor pains and all, of oversight being placed into the hands of elected boards, democratically accountable to the listener members, the labor pains, that's where we are right now. The midwife is having trouble. So we know the why, now it's the how. The means to the end. How is this to be done? Now, this is where we may not be able to share a beer at the local pub. For those inclined to avoid the draft, you'll find no refuge here. There will be no escape from the Pacifican battlefield currently known as Draft A versus Draft B. Within the bylaws revision process, the two competing models for the way in which elections will be structured in the institution, this is the moment. And my need here is to get through to people that this transcends debates on affirmative action. It transcends issues of diversity and goes directly to the heart of what we mean by governance structure and how that is to create the institutional culture of Pacifica. I'll have to make this short because we're running low on time. Draft A, the revision of the bylaws that sets elections into place. Draft A values and upholds candidate diversity based on characteristics such as ethnicity, race, and gender. It upholds diversity above the basic electoral process and the expressed will of the electorate. There will be voting outcome adjustments to send designated unrepresented groups into the elected arena. Unelected into the elected. Draft B values and upholds the democratic process free from election outcome adjustments as the best mechanism to ensure both diversity and institutional accountability. Both methods utilize proportional representation, which is a highly advanced and quite elegant system of creating the structure for diverse candidate fields, diverse groupings of folks to express their will. It is not winner take all. It is a beautiful system that has evolved and exists in many, many countries. Both Draft A and Draft B have what are called committees of inclusion, COIs, committees of inclusion. In Draft B, the committees of inclusion are advisory in nature. In Draft A, the committees of inclusion have what could be seen as executive-style power. And there is a selection process within this committee of inclusion. Some members are elected, and then a series of members are brought into the committee of inclusion based on selection from the people who've been elected. There is a seed of selected members. So, in Draft A, the empowerment comes in the analysis of demographic models of the signal area, and then to determine, describe, and decide which categories deserve enforced representation. In other words, Draft A gives the committee the power to decide how to measure the demographics of the population and then additionally empowers that committee to remedy results when need be with election outcome adjustments. Now, Draft B relies exclusively on the will of the electorate. Once the voting is done, that is the composition, the constitution of the board. I would like to play an excerpt. Dave Fertig is a gentleman who is on. He's a member of the Interim Pacifica National Board. I'm going to play a segment of his description of his experience as part of the Diversity Language Committee. The Diversity Language Committee was charged with writing the language for implementation of remedial mechanisms to include race, ethnicity, gender, other characteristics as elements of diversity implementation in the elections. So I'm playing this because I want you to understand he was an integral part of the Diversity Language Committee, and he has something to say about his experience. So as he goes, you'll understand that he's describing his experiential reality of being part of this Diversity Language Committee. Rocky, can we go to that, please?
You know, going into this, I remain fully prepared to compromise and work out something that would have some kind of remedial mechanism. And again, when I say remedial mechanism, I mean in the event there's an election and the outcome of that election is, by one measure or another, not considered sufficiently diverse. Now, what is sufficiently diverse? Again, how do you measure success? Are we looking at the signal area demographics? To what extent are you drawing specific categories and so forth? But in any event, and if the outcome is not, quote, sufficiently diverse, unquote, then what kind of remedial mechanism do you employ? And this is where you get into the problems with law, because then what you're doing is you're adjusting a voting outcome based on race, gender, national origin, whatever. And these are so-called protected classes. I say so-called because that's how they're referred to in the anti-discrimination laws. I'm a civil rights attorney. I've been doing discrimination work as an attorney for 16 years, but really all my life. And the fact is that this remedial mechanism is where the problem was, because the language that the Diversity Language Committee came up with, among other things, the main issue is that they basically provided that this Committee of Inclusion would have the power to decide how the categories are to be decided and determined, described, how they're to be assessed in terms of, you know, their representation within a single area. And then they would be able to go into the list of candidates who had not been elected but had gotten votes, at least, you know, so many votes so that they're, you know, candidates that had some support and so forth. And then go down there and pick who they felt, who the committee felt in its infinite wisdom would be necessary in order to achieve diversity. And my real concern about that is you're giving a committee the power to decide how you measure success. Okay. But then you're also giving them the power to, when success is found to be wanting, to ameliorate that. And that eliminates a check and balance. I think if you're going to give them the power to measure success, you need to give another entity or just make it an arbitrary system within the bylaws, for example, whereby the committee does not have both its check and its balance. So, and in this instance, what had been proposed, for example, was that you just take up to five, the next five highest vote getters, in order to achieve greater diversity, so that, for example, if you had a majority of men on the board, and of the next five vote getters, say the first one was a man, the next three were women, you take the next four people, and that would bring you more women on the board. But that way you're not skipping over anybody, you're not discounting the votes or the candidacies of others based on their age, race, creed, national origin, gender, etc. And you avoid a lot of legal issues, and you create a mechanism that the committees of inclusion do not have the power to manipulate, whereby they might select this person or that person because they feel that supplies the demographic lacking. That was the main issue that I had with the language. But frankly, the whole process was a fascinating exercise of political combat. And that's what I primarily objected to. In my experience in Pacifica, I have fought very, very hard, and to the great frustration of many of my colleagues, to ensure that we try not to win votes on the margin, that we try to compromise and work with one another and cooperate. And frankly, I felt that at the Diversity Language Committee, there were strong efforts by people to just win at all costs. And I do not believe the ends justify the means. When I'm in a negotiation and I say, okay, I'll go, you know, 5%, and the other side says, okay, well, you come up to 5, we'll come down to 95. And I come up another 10 or 20, and they stay where they are. And I keep compromising. I come closer and closer and closer to the middle. And the person on the other side of the debate refuses to move one inch, because they're so convinced they're right, they will just not even consider a compromise to any degree. At that point, I walk away from the process, because it is not a matter of working together. It's a matter of beating each other up, and I will not engage in that. So that is why I frankly do not feel that the Diversity Language Committee results are reasonable. I think they're more the consequence of political combat. And I think that we as Pacifica need to start demonstrating the kind of political and communitarian sort of cooperative, thoughtful, and open process that we profess. We need to start doing it ourselves. And I'm hoping that once we get these bylaws done, we can get these elections going, we can start putting people onto the board. We can then, if they need to modify this process based on the outcome of the elections, they can do that. But I think that everything that has happened so far has served to delay things, and I'm against that. We need to move forward.
Welcome back to WBAI in New York. It is 11:35 in the a.m. You're listening to Ecologic, Our Common Fate. We are discussing Pacifican history, Pacifica issues, and the current bylaws revision process. Diversity. I would like to just investigate what we mean by diversity. What does diversity mean to us? What is the value we're seeking to express? Obviously, enrichment, learning from each other, to share and build an environment together. Yet, also, for non-whites, I would assume, a righteous desire to balance and correct their historical exclusion from decision-making power. Yet if diversity is brought about by a paternalistic governing body managing election results by a formulaic categorization, will that bring the values and consciousness we respect into the cultural environment we share? While the supporters of Draft Day emphasize the need for guarantees that there will be inclusion, of the need to ensure that all will have a seat at the table, the supporters of Draft B are clearly concerned about the susceptibility for manipulation and abuse of the process, which Draft A does present. Contrary to the noxious ideological chatter which defames supporters of Draft B, I mean, this is happening. Noxious ideological chatter which defames supporters of Draft B as being racist and against affirmative action. In fact, rather, the supporters of Draft B articulate a respect for cultural and individual diversity that translates as a temperament to trust the progressive listener, the progressive listener members who will be able to make manifest an elected accountable governance system comprised of individuals chosen on the basis of their commitment to the mission and the values held dear. So, in essence, what we have here, and it is wonderfully expressed by the unpaid staff representative on the local advisory board, the real issue is the ideological direction of Pacifica and who becomes empowered to direct it. The battle that has ensued allegedly over affirmative action, can be described as a question of who will be empowered to shape the culture. Now, I see a direct indication. Draft B adherents would probably say, what will be empowered? But the language from someone who has been integral to Draft A language creation says, who will be empowered? That's an interesting choice of words. So I would just like to finish up with a final word from Lou Hill. This is Lou Hill speaking. As long as I can communicate with others and they with me, there remains the prospect of our living together and of our making out of our differences and likenesses an integrated, productive community. As long as I can communicate, I can create. As long as I can create, I am free. And conversely, as long as I am able to receive the communication of others, I am able to grow. But if this fundamental condition is eliminated, I am not free. I cannot grow. I cannot create. So I urge everyone who holds dear this institution to transcend the trap of a false debate about affirmative action and diversity. This is about governance structure and what kind of cultural environment we will embrace and take into the future. Thank you for listening. We will return with Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy discussing how things are in the digital environment shortly. Thank you. Welcome back to WBAI in New York. We are speaking to Jeff Chester, the Center for Digital Democracy. Jeff, how are you with us?
Thank you.
Okay, Jeff, I've been speaking today about media as environment, culture ecology. In essence, the way I see it, we are immersed in an information environment, and we need to see how to behave, how to live within that immersion, that saturation in media. And your work is really focusing on the internet, the World Wide Web, the digital domain. Could you give us a bit of a sense of the recent past in terms of what we had democratically existent and what we are maybe losing and what we need to get back in terms of public space and civil society applications?
Well, look, a very much more powerful commercial media culture is emerging in this country and around the world that I think poses dangers and threats for the kind of progressive and social values that many of us have. We already have, obviously, major commercial media apparatus in this country. I agree with you. It is an environment. The media helps set the parameters of consciousness. But the new broadband interactive digital media that's really being planned by the big media conglomerates like AOL, Time Warner, and Comcast and Disney is really designed to further the cause of marketing and advertising, to unleash this incredible power that they have to target you and your kids, no matter where you are, whether you're on a cell phone or walking past a store, they call it location marketing, or in the home, this kind of interactive direct assault at marketing and advertising. Now, that is going to further weaken, I believe, the ability of our society to address problems of social justice, because we're going to be inundated with much more powerful media messages to, frankly, consume and satisfy a different set of needs. And so what the big media companies are doing now is really sort of changing the rules of the game with the Internet so that the Internet is much more accessible to them in terms of advancing their commercial and marketing goals. And I think, frankly, that's a problem and a danger.
So the Internet was introduced as a very open-feeling interface between the individual and the collective. What is happening right now in terms of the capacity to possibly increase open access in public space, and where is this coming down and how quickly is it coming down? Is there a window where if we don't secure public space in this virtual world that the door is going to be closed and we're going to just be in a really bad situation so much sooner?
Well, look, I do think that this is a very important time, the next several years. I don't know how many years exactly, but we're in this transition period. The reason that Viacom and Comcast and all these big companies are going to the FCC, going to Congress, going to the states to overturn safeguards on ownership, to overturn rules around the openness of the Internet, is because they recognize that we're moving from this kind of old media analog world of just television and newspapers to this fully interactive, ubiquitous digital environment, and they want to dominate that environment. But it's very important that during this transition period, we get policies that restrain the power of the giants, that build up the resources for public and non-commercial media and create this kind of commons. Even though the Internet was developed as a defense tool, it was also developed as a free speech tool. If you talk to some of the people that were involved in the very beginning, and the basic DNA, so to speak, of the Internet, according to some of the people that worked on the original network, was it was an open network. It was going to rest on the telephone line. That was a common carrier. All kinds of communications could be carried. There would be nobody to say, oh, I don't like your communication, or I want to slow down or speed up your application because I have a business relationship with you. That was the Internet that we know today. That's principally the dial-up Internet. Mm. That open environment is a threat to the big media companies who primarily want to control the eyeballs, the ears, and the wallets and pocketbooks of American consumers. So as the Internet moved to broadband,
now, can you define broadband for people who aren't familiar with it?
Well, you know, broadband is just a kind of souped-up, higher-speed Internet, so you get your communications faster. But in the world that's emerging, really, you know, television and video and all kinds of multimedia are going to be sent or are being sent down that internet wire. And in order to receive it with reasonable viewing, so to speak, it has to travel over a fiber optic wire, and that's broadband. It's broadband is basically a big fat internet pipeline that can send you a lot of communications and traffic. And broadband is going to be the basic service that most Americans get. Already, I believe it's about 20% of all internet users in the United States have broadband. And yes, there's a digital divide, and we need to deal with it. But the fact of the matter is that the majority of Americans will be receiving their internet and ultimately their television through broadband connections. And it's very critical for the progressive public interest community to have access through broadband to all those individuals if we're going to ever expand our political base on the issues that we care about, let alone providing alternative entertainment and information. So broadband is this big, fat pipeline, and the cable companies and the Bell companies, the former baby Bell companies, like Verizon, have gone to Congress or gone to the Federal Communications Commission and, in essence, have replaced the Internet's open DNA with a more kind of private control they will have over the basic apparatus of the internet itself. Let me explain. Advocates and groups like the ACLU wanted the FCC to affirmatively require that as the internet moves to broadband, it has to have the same kind of public policy safeguards that have governed the dial-up internet. It has to be a wire that treats all traffic equitably, equally, non-discriminatorily, and it has to allow anybody that wants to become an ISP or wants to provide you with a connection to the internet to do so. It has to be an open network. Well, first cable and now the phone companies have been able to get the Federal Communications Commission to come up with a new policy that ends the open access requirement, in essence, and says that there's going to be a monopoly for broadband as it reaches communities across the country. You no longer have a choice of who can provide you with broadband. It's either going to be the phone company or the cable company for the most part. And they get to make private commercial decisions on how that internet traffic is received in your home.
Right.
These big cable monopolies, for example, will be able to impose their own business model on the internet to make sure that the content that they own or that their advertisers own is sent fast and first, is the most prominent, and other content can be slowed down, treated in a discriminatory fashion. So I fear that for much of broadband, it will begin evolving as our entertainment industry has evolved, where the big bucks talk and everybody else
right.
has to walk.
And we would look back on what we have now as a golden era, rather than taking this and expanding it. So now what is the strategy to stop this, to actually get a stake in the public opened space within this monster?
Well, in the first place, there's absolutely no reason why there's no longer any technical reason why there should be any limits at all to the number of TV channels one can have on cable or satellite and to the number of websites. The big companies are going to simply impose those constraints.
So it's not a technological issue.
It's not a technological mm-hmm. problem. Now, the FCC under Michael Powell, and I have to say the Democrats under President Clinton, didn't treat us well either. They refused to give us this kind of open access policy for broadband. Well, groups have taken the FCC to court, and there's a federal court that's going to decide soon, so there's legal remedies. But really what has to happen, and what should happen in the tri-state region, you know, is that people should be really asking locally, their local, you know, city council, or in New York, in the city council, well, wait a second. What are the plans for non-commercial channels for commons? You do regulate cable. The phone company does put their lines through our communities. What are the plans for the broadband internet? How will this network, because remember that even though the internet is a global network, at the end it comes into your town and your community.
Right.
It's
so,
that phone line,
right.
It's that cable line, and people have to start asking questions of local authorities, of state authorities, and your federal legislators to get them to find out what are the corporate plans, what are AOL, Time Warner, or Cablevision's plans, for example, for broadband in those communities, what space is going to be reserved for commons for non-commercial use? How will entrepreneurs and persons of colors and others who have been left out of today's media system be a part of the new media system? Start asking hard questions. Pretty soon we'll learn that we don't have any rights anymore because the big media companies have lobbied them away, and hopefully then there can be also some political response to get some new protections and safeguards and build a movement so there is public space, so there is civic discourse, so there is artistic and cultural expression, and not just a further what I call brand washing of America.
Right, so the local front is actually key for really making very significant gains.
Absolutely, yes. Because the problem is that both parties are really under the control of the big media lobby. So, for example, Senator Clinton hasn't really come out publicly, as far as I know, and complained about the recent FCC decision on media ownership, and she really needs to because, you know, her book contract is with Viacom, Simon & Schuster's Viacom, and Viacom is one of the companies that has sought to overturn all the rules. So pressure needs to occur at the local level, and things can be done at the local level, but it has to trickle up as well nationally.
Right. Now, quickly, we're running quickly out of time. Can you tell us what's happening this week that people need to know about?
Well, WBA listeners have a real opportunity to give the media lobby its biggest political defeat in decades, and I hope they will do so. This Thursday, the key committee in the Senate is voting to reverse the recent FCC decision on media concentration. The FCC recently gave the big media lobby almost everything they wanted that will allow a handful of companies to control most of the media in the community. There's a move in the Senate Commerce Committee to reverse the FCC. I hope that your listeners will phone, email, fax, scream at their senators. And the message is, reverse the FCC. This Thursday, we can have a big victory for the public interest.
And if they go to your website, they can get more
DemocraticMedia.org. There's another one, MediaReform.org, CommonCause.org.
Okay.
There are those websites there. Help us send a blow to the media lobby this Thursday.
So democraticmedia.org. And do you have a phone number that people can contact as well?
202-452-9898. We really need BAI's listeners to help us. They were mad as hell, and we're not going to take politics as usual anymore.
202-452-9898.
That's
Jeff,
right.
I'm sorry we didn't have more time, and I appreciate you being there for us. And
thank you and the BAI listeners.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Okay, thank you very much for tuning in. Tried to fit in that interview amidst many thoughts. Please contact WBAI.org for further information on the bylaws and engaging with your local station and your national network, WBAI.org and WBAI.net. And you can also go to bylawsdebate@hotmail.com, bylawsdebate@hotmail.com. Thank you for listening. This is David O. with EcoLogic.
EcoLogic was brought to you live with portions on recording over listener-supported community radio WBAI in New York.